From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Secretary of State Colin Powell today warned Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to back off the war talk. On Monday, the Prime Minister had told the Knesset, it's us or them, our backs are to the wall, but all is not lost. We will win, but this is war, and it will take a long time. Powell is talking tough now, but what else has the United States done for the Middle East peace process lately? President Bush has rebuffed appeals from visiting Egyptian President Mubarak for more U.S. involvement and said no thanks to Mubarak's offer to hold a peace summit. Washington has been only distantly supportive of the Saudi peace initiative. As violence escalates to unprecedented levels, how much longer can the United States stay on the sidelines? In this hour, America's response and responsibility as the Middle East tips toward war. Is it time for the U.S. to roll up its sleeves and dig in? Secretary of State Colin Powell isn't the only one taking issue with Prime Minister Sharon's war talk. Sharon's own foreign minister, Shimon Peres, has threatened to resign if the government pursues a purely military strategy against the Palestinians. Today, in a press conference, Peres outlined his conditions for staying in the Sharon government. Harvey Morris has been following this unfolding political crisis for the Financial Times. Earlier, I asked him what Peres said and how he thought it would all shake out.
I think he'll do whatever he can to stay within the government. It's his personal outlook that he wants to remain a part of the process. But I think events in recent days have pushed him to an absolute limit in which he's come out with his bottom line of what he wants in order to continue in the coalition. And that is essentially that he wants Prime Minister Sharon to hold out some prospect of a political solution to this crisis. He's not happy with the idea that it can be solved militarily. What we now have to wait for is for Sharon to respond, and I think there is a meeting scheduled in the next day or two between the two men to see if they can't reach some sort of compromise.
Sharon has been pulling in the opposite direction. He's begun this week to use the word war, which has today drawn a response from U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. How do the politics of the population of Israel appear to break down at this point?
I think that the events of recent weeks have been such a shock, in a way, to the Israeli public that they want both things at once. If you look at the opinion polls, as many people who think that the government should deal very harshly with the Palestinians also think that there should be a negotiated solution. So the findings of the opinion polls are very confusing for the Prime Minister. And indeed, some Palestinian officials say that at the moment, Mr. Sharon is opting for the hard line that he's getting from the polls and not looking towards the conciliatory line.
We see this polarity of options facing Israel. Likud members talking about recapturing the entire West Bank, at least for a time, to, I guess they would say, clean up the terrorists and perhaps to push out the Palestinian Authority. On the other side, Saudis are talking about the Israelis withdrawing entirely from the West Bank. Do either of these extreme options seem likely to come about?
Let's take the Saudi one first. It's been greeted quite positively in Israel. I mean, in the first few days of the Saudi initiative, even right-wingers within the government were saying, well, this is a positive move. That's changed slightly in the last few days. It now is mainly Mr. Peres and the Labour Party are still have some confidence in the Saudi option. I think everybody regards it as a starting position. In other words, the idea that Israel would withdraw entirely from all the territories conquered in 67 is seen in Israel as unrealistic. But nevertheless, they accept it could be a starting point for negotiations. As for whether Israel should reconquer the territories, which is the demand of some people on the far right, frankly, it's an impractical proposition. It would require a huge call-up of reserve forces. There's already unrest within the reserve camp about serving in the territories, and it would really ratchet up the conflict to quite a different level.
How does Netanyahu figure in to the positions of Ariel Sharon, of Shimon Peres?
Well, I think that Netanyahu is in a comfortable position in that he doesn't actually have any political authority at the moment. So it's very easy for him to sit to the right of Mr. Sharon and snipe from the fringes. In the opinion polls, a lot of right-wing voters say that they would prefer him as the candidate at the next elections. And certainly his standing within the Likud party, which is also Mr. Sharon's party, is quite strong. Whether he would offer any different strategy at the moment is doubtful. And, of course, there are no elections due for at least another year. So unless the government collapses totally, Mr. Sharon is there for at least 12 months more.
Is it possible, though, that Netanyahu's hard-line rivalry is pushing Sharon toward a tougher stance?
There have been suggestions of that, and certainly that is the case over the issue of the movement of Yasser Arafat. A couple of weeks back, the cabinet decided to maintain a siege on Mr. Arafat in Ramallah, and of course the people on the left are very keen that he should be able to go to the Arab summit in Beirut and maybe give a little impetus to the Saudi peace proposals. The Sharon government turned that down, and there are suggestions that he turned it down because he was worried that if he eased up on Arafat, that that would give Netanyahu an opening to say that he was going soft on the Palestinians.
So far, the Bush administration's role in the situation has been largely hands-off, striking contrast with the Clinton administration's approach. How do the various factions within Israel view this hands-off U.S. policy?
Well, I think the government and Mr. Sharon are relatively happy with that at the moment. I mean, he doesn't want anyone, whether it's Washington or the Europeans, jumping in and saying, look, you have to do the following. This is our strategy, which you have to pursue. He feels he's got more or less a green light from the Americans to pursue a military course at the moment. And I think he's quite happy that he has the Americans on side. The Labour Party, it has to be said, and people on the left, and indeed moderates within the Palestinian camp, are saying we want an international contribution to this dispute at this time. We need a third party to come in and help us sort it out.
Harvey Morris is a reporter for the Financial Times. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. We're talking about America's role as Israel and the Palestinians slide into something very much like war. Secretary of State Colin Powell told Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to cut out the war talk today and said Yasser Arafat must do more to stop bloodshed. But is the United States ready to cut itself into the peace process so that a full-scale war doesn't break out? What is America's role and responsibility here? Should the United States or the UN propose a new solution? Impose a new solution? Can America afford to do nothing? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me in the studio is Mark Gopin. He's a visiting associate professor of international diplomacy at Tufts Fletcher School. Good evening and welcome, Mark Gopin.
Evening.
And with us from Virginia is Mohammed Abu Nimer. He's a specialist in peace and conflict resolution and a professor at American University's School of International Service. Good evening and welcome, Mohammed Abu Nimer.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thank you for being with us. Mark Gopin, to you first. We see the bloodshed now just ratcheting up day by day between Israelis and Palestinians, reaching levels and expressions that despite the long, long history of conflict there, few had ever imagined they might see. It seems like every boundary is being crossed. There's no clear end or stopping point to this. And then, of course, it occurs in a global context, in a regional context and a global context. We're talking tonight about what America ought to be doing, and there's many reasons for ought. But I guess one question is, what are the costs in geopolitical terms to the United States of this conflict continuing to spiral out of control into bloodshed toward war?
Well, there's obviously a debate within the administration about that. I mean, I think that most people would assume that an increasing level of bloodshed is making it that much more difficult to create a consensus across countries on a war on terrorism. But it's obvious that the security arm, the National Security Council and the vice president, don't feel that this is a threat to American interests in the region. And yet it seems that Secretary Powell does. So there's obviously division on that. My personal opinion is that it's a very short-sighted approach to the United States' interests in the region.
What do you think could be the cost to those interests of this conflict continuing to spiral down?
There's already been a huge cost in terms of the cheapening of life here. I mean, it just feels as if as long that Jews and Palestinians can die in large numbers, as long as it doesn't threaten regional arrangements and regional cooperation, at least covertly on the war on terrorism. But that just further fuels the deep resentment on the popular level. And it's the popular level that has given rise to so much of the need to fight a war on terrorism.
And what might that popular bitterness in the Islamic world mean long term for the U.S.?
Long term, it's just increasingly an entire generation of young people who are growing up with the images and Al Jazeera of Palestinians, of Muslims being shot and being their houses being continually bombed. And I don't believe it can just be a war of attrition like in other places. This is inherently destabilizing. We will reach a point in which Arafat chooses to use his army, and then there will be an all-out war between a caliber of reserves in Israel and Arafat's own army. So this is getting worse and worse, and there are blinders on in terms of that.
Mohammed Abu Nimer, what's your interpretation of Washington's distant posture? The Bush administration has come in, kept a hands-off approach, and continues to keep a relatively hands-off approach, even as things get very bad. We heard earlier from our Financial Times correspondent in Israel that many in Israel may be just fully satisfied with that on Washington with that posture on Washington's part. But why do you think the Bush administration is taking this hands-off position?
And I just allow me to say that I agree with Mark that there has been, since last November and the last year, a mixed signal from the administration, from Washington towards the Middle East, that in which it started with the hands-off policy and then realizing within just a couple of months that this policy doesn't work, and then dispatching, I would say, middle-level to low-level envoys. Again, that one did not work. And clearly, I agree with Mark that hands-off policy will actually mean a green light to Sharon and the Israeli massive weapon and military to crush the Palestinian civilian as well as security. And I think, as Mark indicated, that is against the interest of the U.S. foreign policy. So,
but we're trying to understand why, Mohammed Abu Nimer. Today, President Bush stood with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, as large a figure as you want to have in Washington from the Middle East, and basically said, no, thank you, we're not going to get involved. He politely dismissed an offer from Mubarak to host a summit in Egypt between Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Ariel Sharon. And President Bush said again that it's that the violence has to stop, essentially a message to Yasser Arafat, which, repeated by Colin Powell, you can, you should, you must stop the violence before we can solve this. Why do you think the United States is taking this position? Why?
Well, I mean, again, I think it's a foreign policy mistake that has been...
It may be a mistake, but can you take us inside the mind at all of the administration? It's clearly not a thoughtless error. There's a lot of thinking going on.
Yeah, I think two things they tried to explain. One, the previous administration was too much involved in the peace process. Therefore, we're not going to repeat the mistake. And supposedly, in their mind, it's a mistake. And we're going to prove that until those two parties are exhausted by the war and the killing, then they might be willing to accept our mediation in a way, and our mediation will be effective. These are the only two explanation I sort of can come up with. On the other hand, I totally agree with Mark. This is a disaster for the war against terrorism and war against violence, because the images of Palestinians being killed, massacred every day, it only fuels Muslims and Arabs around the world.
Mohammed Abu Nimer, we've got to take a break. And, of course, you know the images of Israelis dying fuels a lot of anger as well. Should the United States stay on the sidelines as Israel and the Palestinians spiral into war? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the rapidly deteriorating situation between Israel and the Palestinians. The violence has grown day by day. Today, the headlines say Bush administration signals a parting with Sharon, and quote, Secretary of State Colin Powell saying Prime Minister Sharon has to take a hard look at his policies to see whether they will work. But at the same time, the United States makes very clear, and Colin Powell made clear, that it wants Yasser Arafat to stop the Palestinian violence against Israelis. And beyond all that, the United States continues to stay effectively on the sidelines. Is that the right posture for the United States now? Should Washington dive back in with a proposed solution, with an imposed solution? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Mark Gopin, visiting associate professor of international diplomacy at Tufts Fletcher School, and Mohammed Abu Nimer, professor at American University's School of International Service. Mark Gopin, just before the break, Mohammed Abu Nimer was discussing with us why the Bush administration has been so reluctant to get involved here, even as things have come to this terrible point that they are at now. What's your further thinking?
Right. I'd like to point out also that, I mean, from what I know and from the stories that are going on around the administration, is that there's a personal antipathy that developed ever since the failure of Camp David, with a sense of betrayal on behalf of the leadership between their relationship with Yasser Arafat, and Cheney and Zinni. There's a very strong sense of antipathy, of an unreliability, of a two-faced quality that they simply there's simply a great deal of rage, particularly with accompanied by the images of people celebrating when the towers went down. And all of these things create a reluctance, almost an allergy to taking him seriously as a leader.
But antipathy describes a kind of emotional response, and who couldn't understand that when peace seemed so close and then was lost? But we like to think of U.S. national security policy being determined on a basis other than emotion.
Well, I think that the sad reality of realpolitik, and this goes for a number of the regimes in the Middle East as well, is that the actual situation of Palestinians on the ground has always been a fairly low priority. The higher priority is how states are interacting. And as long as they have their eggs in order with the regimes in the region, this is the fact that these people have chosen a leader that they find it impossible to deal with is their problem in some sense.
But surely 9/11 and everything that, since then,
right,
must lead to a reconsideration of what stability means, how stable these relationships with regimes in the Middle East are, about the long-term quality and texture of the U.S. relationships there.
There are a lot of people who still don't get the fact that, rightly or wrongly, the state and condition of the Palestinian people on the ground is a fundamental crux of the issue of terrorism globally, and that those images and that symbol is essential to the problem. But I would also add that I know that quietly there is an effort to pressure Sharon and others to have a more humanitarian posture on the ground. In other words, they're not touching his antipathy to Arafat and his wish to isolate Arafat. Unfortunately, there's no disagreement there, but there is pressure quietly on more humanitarian gestures. So it's an odd situation here.
Mohammed Abu Nimer, what about the Saudi plan? Syria chimed in today and said it would support the Saudi initiative. Is it possible that Washington sees a potential initiative on the horizon here that may potentially gain steam, and it prefers to sit back and, for a change, try and let the region work this out for itself?
I think the Saudi plan is a great step, you know, toward renegotiating. But eventually, if you look at the Saudi plan, it has been approved since 1996 by all the Arab states in Cairo in their meeting or conference. I think it's a great step toward renegotiation. But as you indicated, there is a need for the U.S. to step in. There is a need for the European to step in and stop this madness from going on. The killing of the insecurity of Israelis and the insecurity of the Palestinians on the ground doesn't allow much support for negotiation. And the only way to start with this negotiation is really to let Arafat out of his trap. I think by framing the conflict as it is leadership of Arafat, we're moving the focus from Sharon and also what the Israeli military is doing. I think Arafat cannot be that effective if he is himself under prison. How do you expect a prisoner to exercise influence and control over his people? So I think.
And yet, you heard Mark Gopin's description of the severe disappointment in Washington with Yasser Arafat when peace seemed so close. The finger wagging goes in both directions, and yet here's the problem: the fighting goes on and it gets worse. We have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's bring them in. Should the United States stay on the sidelines as Israel and the Palestinians spiral into war? Do you agree with President Bush that the U.S. should not get involved? Can the global superpower afford to let this fire rage? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I would have to say that being in my mid-40s and growing up as a child and graduating high school and actually having to sign up for the end of the Vietnam era and growing up with CBS News and a death toll and a count of wounded and body counts, that I cannot see that we could be escalated into a type of crisis away from our homeland soil, especially since we're already on the Afghani front fighting, which is so-called a coalition that the European countries.
John, your line is breaking up on us, but what I'm hearing you saying is you fear that the U.S. might end up involved militarily, and I'm hearing you saying you would not support that. I'm sorry for the bad phone line, but thanks for your call. Mark Gopin, U.S. involvement can take many forms. U.S. military involvement has never been much of a major direct factor in this particular conflict. Do you see that on the table, or what steps might Washington take shy of that that would be significant in addressing this conflict as it stands now?
Well, one thing resonates from what John said, and that is that you have to realize when there is a war, when there are real criminal activities, and you have a reasonable success of defeating, say, terrorism. But this is a conflict where it's just only going to be body counts until it gets to more body counts. And I sense his futility, and I agree with that. He's wrong that Zinni over there going between the sides has anything to do with military involvement. That's really completely off the table. I could even understand if Powell and Cheney are busy with the war on terrorism. But Zinni's not busy, and there's absolutely no reason. There's every evidence that when there were negotiations, there was terrorism, but there was never this widespread support for extreme activity.
But what meaningful
step... So it's just a tactical error in terms of preventing regional instability.
But Mark Gopin, Zinni sat there, and he looked utterly ineffective. What meaningful step could the United States now... You heard our reporter say earlier, the Israeli government is just as happy to have the United States stay out. Yasser Arafat is not in much position to respond even right now to overtures from Washington. What meaningful steps could Washington take at this point to change the circumstances on the ground, to change the direction of the conflict there?
Mohammed
Abu Niber.
Three things could be done by the U.S. One is a symbolic force. A few hundred soldiers with the support of the European, with the support of the United Nations, to be placed in certain areas, Bethlehem, Ramallah, in order to establish a permanent ceasefire or a viable ceasefire. A second thing, dispatching a higher rank convoy to the Middle East to send a message that we are serious about our involvement. A third step could be very meaningful in this one, is to communicate, as Bush administration did in November and December twice, to Sharon, without lifting the siege around the Palestinian cities and towns, there would be no ceasefire, there would be no stopping of these suicidal attacks. And I think giving Arafat something that he could go back to his people and say, you see, if we engage in negotiation, we could get something more for this compromising position.
And what about a fourth step, Mohammed Emer, which is the one that the Bush administration is already repeatedly raising, that is, Palestinians stop the terrorist attacks?
But you see, the Palestinian, who's going to tell the Palestinian sub? Arafat, he's a prisoner. He doesn't have any way to influence his people while he's a prisoner. He could have some influence, but it would be really ridiculing his leadership by being a prisoner of the Israeli and being humiliated on a daily basis by being called the pet or the dog in the kennel.
And yet, Colin Powell says today, Mr. Arafat has to do more, can do more, must do more.
May I remind you that Arafat done lots, I mean, almost 90% of what he could up just about few weeks ago, before this recent eruption, and he could not get anything in response, any meaningful response, neither from the administration nor from the Israeli side. I think we are in a trap of leadership that is not interested in a political compromise.
Mark Gopin.
You know, in many ways, there's a lot of bad leaderships all around.
I fully agree
that there has been a curious way from the very beginning in which, when you saw a lull in the violence, there was another assassination from the IDF. It created more violence, and you get the sense that maybe somebody on the other side wasn't interested in creating a deal. But it has to be said, with the Karine and with a lot of curious behavior, that Mr. Arafat speaks two different languages, and that he, on the one hand, speaks about writes in the New York Times about peace, and the other hand, the Karine had C4, the captured ship, which is $15 million. That
50
was
50 tons of arms.
Yes, it had C4 in it. It was clear
plastic
that it
explosives.
Could be used for bombs. I don't know who's really in charge there. Sometimes I've gone back and forth and feel that he claims to be in charge, but he's not all that in charge. Mm. But whatever the case, this cries out for effective, forceful third parties that hold people to their agreements and keep them talking to each other, because it will lessen the violence.
Mark Gopin, Mohammed Abu Nimer, stand by. Ralph is on the line. Welcome, Ralph. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Good evening.
I want to dispute one of the underlying assumptions of what you've been saying.
All right.
That is that the U.S. is staying on the sidelines. The U.S. has, for at least the last 20 years, given Israel $3 billion a year, $1.8 billion of which is in arms aid, which I believe is mostly sales from arms companies like Lockheed Martin's, which are then recompensed by the U.S. government back to Lockheed. So my proposal, first of all, to make the U.S. an actually even-handed party is that the U.S. arms aid should be decreased by at least $1 billion a year starting immediately, and that money should go to the U.N., and I believe also the U.N. should make U.S. should make some effort to try to make this practical, that the U.N. should set up an administration which would give the $1 billion to poor Palestinians, many of which do not even have plumbing and do not have pure water, because the Israeli settlements get the first water rights.
Well, it's a radical proposal, but maybe it's time for radical proposals. Mark Gopin, what about it? Ralph says, end the military aid, put the money into economic development, and maybe we can end run this whole conflict. But that it could be that simple, or somehow we wish it could. Could
right.
it work?
Well, when I could... Let's talk about the military aid. The military aid has been to Egypt and Jordan and Israel at the same time, and it's a long history in the East-West confrontation in the Cold War of arming both sides of the hilt and profiting from it. I agree with you. I wish that a tenth of the military budget would go into serious programming to improve people's lives. I don't necessarily trust as much as you do the United Nations to actually do that. I don't necessarily trust the PA to do that, but I know that if we got a break and people got serious about that, then the money could be effectively used if it was carefully monitored. But I don't think the answer is to punish anybody, but to try and shift the consciousness of war fighting towards poverty fighting and misery fighting and honoring people's lives rather than shaming them into deals.
Mark Gopin, to Ralph's point, what would it take for to get the U.S. into the position of proposing something like that? I mean, this just isn't funny anymore. It's not been funny for a long time for Israelis or Palestinians, and now clearly for the United States either. Why can't the U.S. get out of the box? Why do we seem to be stuck in the kind of endless Camp David talks and the endless envoy visits and failures? Why not an out-of-the-box solution of some kind?
At the present time, I think that the administration is fighting its war on terrorism. And like I said, Palestinian life has never been a high priority. There are lobbies in Washington, but I believe that we were much, much closer than ever before in the Oslo period to moving towards a solution. There wasn't enough time to really close a deal. It was many things were brought up way too late. And more importantly than anything, the Oslo process failed to bring people and their basic security and needs into the formula. We have to rethink this entirely and have a long-term strategy of America, constructive American involvement.
Ralph, I hear you wanting to come back in.
Hello?
Oh, Mohammed. I'm sorry. Mohammed Abu Nimer, please.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ralph's suggestion is, you know, one of these out-of-the-box or suggestion. It's great. It does also indicate that I disagree with Mark. I mean, he's a colleague, and we work together in many cases. But we have to be critical of the $3.5 billion given to Israel and used in the West Bank to finance the military and the oppression of the Palestinian. Also, the U.S. could take a more active role by making sure that the settlements are not expanded, by investing more in the economic situation of the Palestinian in improving their life, standards of life. We had about 6 or 7 years of Oslo, and all the economic development on the ground were actually opposite to what the Palestinians have thought the peace dividends might bring for them. So one suggestion is to shift the economic aid to the Palestinian in a way it will be substantial in improving their economic situation, as well as making some more pressure. Mark knows, and I know that very, very clearly, that with Sharon's current policy, there is no way the Palestinians and the Israeli two communities can reach a peaceful resolution. What we need is the Labor Party, the peace movement in Israel, to move and exercise some of its influence in order to change that government, and instead of to try to make Arafat change the leadership of Arafat.
Mm. But Mohammed Abu Nimer, perhaps you point to something interesting there. We're talking as though the United States could just intervene and solve things, but maybe it is Israelis and Palestinians themselves that have to do it. As you say, does the Labor Party have to make a move? Are we exaggerating the direct leverage and power that the United States has to bring a radical shift in toward peace here?
If they keep doing what they did last time, then it will be futile and pointless.
If the U.S. keeps doing
the
same?
If the United States keeps doing what it did last time, the Camp David routine, the elitist process of talking endlessly and not changing people's lives and not involving a people-to-people constructive process, both of diplomacy but also of improving people's lives.
But this is not American territory. Can the United States accomplish that?
Absolutely. It takes a shift in the concept of what diplomacy is all about, away from power elites and more towards changing people's lives, so that they give the leaders, both Sharon and Arafat, the political space to make the compromises that they will need to make for a final deal. No one has ever thought about that. And secondly, they think that shame works. Shame doesn't work. It doesn't work for either the Israelis or the Palestinians.
We're talking about the United States, the Israelis, and the Palestinians. Should the United States be more involved now? If the United States should do something, what should it do? And what is the cost to the United States of this endless emotional conflict? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about whether it's time for the United States to get back involved in an old way or a new way in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as it spirals out of control. Should Washington dive back in with a proposed solution, with an imposed solution? Can the global superpower afford to let this fire rage? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are joined by Mark Gopin of the Tufts Fletcher School, author of the soon-to-be-released Holy War, Holy Peace from Oxford University Press, and from the American University's School of International Service by Mohammed Abu Nimer. On the line now is Yale. Welcome, Yale. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
The question itself, should the United States dive back in, seems disingenuous.
Say how, Yale?
The United States has been deeply involved without interruption since the founding of the State of Israel.
Well, of course, there's a fundamental involvement, but do you not see the difference in involvement between what's going on right now and what went on, let's say, a year ago?
The point is that the United States has never played the role of honest broker. The rest of the world and the Palestinians are perfectly aware of that. And when what the rest of the world sees as the legitimate way to deal with this, that is to have the United Nations or a world body administer or supervise the discussions, the U.S. has vetoed resolutions in the Security Council which have suggested, for example, that a U.N. force be introduced in order to bring down the level of violence or to supervise a ceasefire. Mm. This idea that we can somehow leap in when our role as the principal supporter of one of the protagonists is so well known, it's really shameful.
Well, I'm not sure what exactly is shameful, but we take your fundamental point and we thank you for your call. Mark Gopin, Yale says, look, it's an illusion to see the United States as an honest broker here, and so U.S. involvement is not going to lead to peace. Do you buy that?
The word honest broker is not helpful in conflict resolution. The truth of the matter is that nobody's neutral. The United Nations, the Europeans, there's very few parties that are neutral. I think there were some people to trust, but not the United Nations as a neutral. It's a matter of whether you can get a party that can speak to both parties at the same time and make positive movements towards peace and justice.
So can the United States play that role, or, as Yale suggests, is that just not going to happen?
It's gotten close a few times, but it hasn't been very successful. It was successful between Egypt and Israel. It has been successful in the Israeli-Jordanian relationship, but not in many of the other relationships, and certainly not with regard to the Palestinians. But it doesn't mean it can't happen. And Israelis have a real allergy to United Nations blue helmets that scurried away not a few times when their lives were in danger. So there isn't a sense of that being the third-party neutral.
Mohammed Abu-Nimer?
Yeah, I agree there is no neutrality. But, Mark, there is difference between a full bias, one party like the U.S., $3 billion, a lack of monitoring of settlement, giving the Apache, giving the weapon to the Israeli to use against the Palestinian, then the U.S. become a party. I think the difference between the Clinton administration during that time, which, by the way, a period of 5 years, the violence was the lowest in its scale in so many other countries, Latin America, Asia, Africa. The Palestinian-Israeli conflict was in its lowest point in terms of violence and terrorism, as you would use the term also. So the difference with the Clinton administration, that he or that administration was able to reach out to the Palestinian in a way to balance to some extent, maybe not in money, but at least in rhetoric, the Clinton visit to Gaza, the different ways that administration managed to reach out to the Palestinian allow them to negotiate.
So, Mohammed Abu-Nimer, you're an Israeli-Palestinian. From your view, despite the United States posture over time, you see Washington as potentially an aid to peace?
It could be, again, I gave many examples how with issues of aid shifting a little bit to the Palestinian, providing a protection on the ground, a third point involving other parties, European and the United Nations, into this third party panel or mediating place. But at its present right now, the United States is very biased, having imbalanced policy toward this conflict, and their credibility is not very high in the region. I think there could be some concrete ways in which the U.S. could reach the Palestinian and re-engage them in the negotiation in this process. Although the major bulk of work need to be done with the powerful party right now, the Sharon military machine is at work on a daily basis.
But the Bush administration has got a global war on terror going on, and they have seen Sharon, it appears, as an ally in this war, in fighting terrorism.
Arafat donated blood for the first time in his life to express his sympathy and asking to be an ally with the Americans in their war against terrorism. Somehow that passed all the screens of the media and the policy in Washington. I don't know how you describe Sharon allies in terrorism, but as Mark indicated early on, the more Palestinians killed on the ground, the more images of Palestinians being bombarded and their houses are demolished, you're going to add fuel to the anger and the frustration of many Muslims around the world.
Mm. Jackie is on the line. Welcome, Jackie. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
If you recall, after World War II, when Russia, Soviet Union invaded so many of the Central European countries,
yes,
Czechoslovakia and Poland and all of them, we never showed that we were defending the Soviet Union. We didn't help to arm them to keep up that occupation.
What's your point, Jackie?
Well, we're doing the same thing. We're doing that, the opposite of that over there in Israel. We are defending Israel and actually arming it and have armed it all these years.
But Israel's a longtime ally. Don't you think it has a right to exist there?
Yes, I do. But they should not be there occupying land in Palestine that has been set aside for Palestinians. And how can possibly anybody in that country, when they are occupied by another country, how can any leader, especially an imprisoned one, how can anyone ever stop the people there from protesting? As even during the Russian occupation, Czechoslovakia rose up, some countries tried to protest. And
Jackie, we've got your point. I want to put it to Mark Gopin. Thanks for your call, Jackie. Mark Gopin, is it possible, given the strong, strong feelings in Israel about the country's security, about the West Bank, is there the political possibility of peace here along the lines that Jackie describes, that the Saudi plan suggests, the land for peace? Can it ultimately actually happen?
We're far more distant from it than we ever were before. We had at least 75% of the Israeli electorate committed to a peaceful settlement, and you see this automatically go down with each suicide terrorism. And this is something that the Palestinian and Arab world that funds those terrorists have never understood about what violence really does. It changes people's opinions. It makes them hate. It makes them fear. People are sick with fear and rage in Israel. They're not going anywhere anymore. It's a pretty terrible situation. And I know it's horrible on the other side as well. But this is a situation where it cannot really proceed until there is strong intervention to help both sides reduce the violence. But this is a highly reactive process. The terrorists keep on coming, and then the excessive force, the strong force of the Sharon military apparatus becomes very strong and creates more casualties. But it is a tit for tat here, and this great frustration that Arafat hasn't come through in stopping those suicide terrorists. I understand the limitations of his position, but I think that their intelligence suggests to them that he's playing both sides.
Mohammed Abu-Nimer, we only have about a minute left. What about the Palestinian Authority? Are they in a position to be a peace partner in all of this?
The Palestinian Authority and Arafat at this point and always have been the only viable party on the Palestinian side to negotiate. And I think they've expressed their willingness to negotiate all along these years. The problem, as we indicated, there was no improvement on the ground, and the U.S. foreign policy did not follow up with the monitoring of this agreement on the ground. And now we are in a very bad position because of the fact that Sharon is in power and he's not willing to accept even the minimal that Paris or Barat or other would offer. With Sharon, we cannot get to a a possible agreement on the ground.
And Mark Gopin, we just have a couple seconds left. What might bring the United States back in a more interventionist, forceful way into this process? Very quickly.
What might bring it back? I think if they start to realize that that the core of this conflict is a people-to-people conflict, and they need to focus on the protection of both these populations, it will bring them back finally to help both sides move in that direction.
Mark Gopin, author of the soon-to-be-released Holy War, Holy Peace, from Oxford University Press. Thank you for being with us tonight. And Mohammed Abu Nimer, professor at American University's School of International Service. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Listeners, you can view a graphical map of the Saudi plan to bring peace to the Middle East by visiting our website. The address is onpointradio.org. On Monday, former Senator George Mitchell, architect of the so-called Mitchell Plan for Peace in Israel, spoke at the John F. Kennedy Library. After a speech about his experience as mediator in Northern Ireland, Mitchell was asked what role he thinks the United States should play in finding a resolution in Israel. Here's his response.
I don't think it is so much the American position that has to change as the degree of American involvement. And I believe that the President and the Secretary of State are well aware of that and taking steps to create the sustained effort that will be required to bring about a resumption of negotiation. The reality is, of course, that one of the reasons for the hostility of large numbers of Arabs to the United States is the widespread belief that the United States policy is biased in favor of Israel. At the same time, by overwhelming numbers, the people and governments of those countries want greater American involvement. In fact, if you meet with the leaders of Arab countries, as I do regularly, they're one request, and they state it publicly, is we want the United States more involved. Crown Prince Abdullah's comment after making his proposal was, it's now up to the Americans. I want the Americans to get involved. That reflects a recognition that there's simply not going to be a resolution of conflict without active American leadership and participation. It is not arrogance, but a simple statement of fact that the United States is the only nation, power, now in a position to create the conditions in which meaningful negotiation can take place and guarantee the implementation of an agreement once reached. And that, I think, is what it's going to take. It is, in my judgment, clear that left to their own devices, the parties will not resolve this conflict. On the very first day that the negotiations began in Northern Ireland, I said to the delegates that I do not come here with an American plan. There is no Clinton plan. There is no Mitchell plan. I come here with the objective of creating a circumstance in which you can directly compose among yourselves a resolution. And that's what happened. They reached the agreement, but they would not have been in a position to even discuss reaching an agreement but for American participation. And I believe, to some extent, perhaps to an even greater extent, that's what exists now in the Middle East.
George Mitchell speaking at the JFK Library on Monday. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Schoolchim Bachari, Tim Monroe, Tim Skog, Isabella Tabarovsky, and Laura Tanguso. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.